Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
During the last legislative session, Utah lawmakers passed a bill that ordered the state's public universities to cut about $60 million from their budgets. Now, lawmakers said the schools could get that money back if they reinvested it in departments and classes that train students for high-demand jobs like artificial intelligence and nursing and data science. But they said, you're going to have to get rid of the classes that are inefficient. That is, the ones that had low enrollment or limited job prospects. And at this point, the schools have done most of the cutting, and this may not surprise you. By far, it was the humanities and the arts that took the hardest hit. And even before the session began, Courtney Tanner of the Salt Lake Tribune saw this coming.
When these cuts first started being bandied about, I was curious how it happened in other states. So I found this professor, David C.K. Curry. He'd written some opinion pieces about the value of liberal arts and kind of seeing those go away at his school. It ended up being this really interesting story. He teaches philosophy, and he'd had some of the professors in his department retire, and the university just kind of stopped filling them. So he's kind of seeing his own department get whittled down. And then they start throwing around this word, realignment, kind of a buzzword. And then they bring in a consulting firm and they're starting to say efficiency, and he's starting to get nervous. You know, these are kind of terms that people would associate with cuts. The university started putting out these metrics, these numbers that they were supposed to hit for students picking majors and graduating and finding jobs. Then they started cutting programs. They started cutting liberal arts, as he was worried about. Art history went away, dance, theater, music performance, French, Spanish, you know, all of these fields that are like humanities and social sciences. He just started seeing his university being pared back. Those buzzwords that he heard, he started seeing here. He started seeing this audit that we had about, quote, inefficient programs. And he said, oh my gosh, the language that Utah's seeing is exactly the same as what I went through. And he's trying to warn people, you know, like, look, this devastated my school. And I can see you're at the start of this. I'm trying to warn you against it. You know, this has played out at institutions across the country in different states. And Indiana is now going through the same process that Utah just finished up. And so essentially what he's seeing is this kind of Republican war against higher education. I think if you look nationally too, I mean, it's no surprise that President Donald Trump, you know, what he's done with higher education, attacking universities, attacking their budgets. And it really does seem to be this kind of targeted focus from the right on how higher education operates and how to make it, quote, more efficient.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Now, it's important to say the legislators who wanted to impose these efficiencies on Utah universities have said they're not trying to target the liberal arts. Representative Karen Peterson, who was the primary sponsor of the bill, mentioned that when she was in college, she valued those classes. But she said her bill was about making every dollar count. And just last week, the University of Utah president, Taylor Randall, said it was fair for lawmakers to ask how they're spending their money. But, of course, this is all going to raise questions about the future of the humanities in higher education. Yes, this is a time when schools are focused on jobs and efficiency, but don't the liberal arts fit in there somewhere? And what happens if or when public universities sideline critical thinking and creativity and virtue? That was a word that came up more than a few times in our conversations about this. But before we get there, let's go back to Courtney Tanner to understand just how we got here.
Kind of the first sign that we got that something was off was this big state audit that came out in the fall. It was November. essentially state lawmakers had requested this audit to look into universities and how well essentially those university programs were performing in the state. And they used certain metrics to scrutinize that. So the programs had to be graduating students, they had to be leading to high paying jobs, and they had to be jobs that the state needed in its workforce. And so it does this huge audit and it basically finds like, all these colleges have all these inefficient programs and you need to cut them immediately. That was kind of the advice of the audit. And then lawmakers are like, well, hey, look at this audit. You know, it points exactly to like what we want to do. And then they start rolling out their plan to cut the budget and have schools cut their programs.
It seems like according to the audit and then the way lawmakers are sort of taking that audit and running with it is they identify some of the programs, some of the classes that are, I won't say legit, I'll say high performing and those that are low performing. The high performers are what? Engineering, nursing?
Yeah, you hit it on the head. The legit programs are kind of the ones you'd think of that lead to like higher paying jobs. Business in particular, the state likes to see engineering, the sciences, nursing. And not so much the, the non-legit ones. So like anything that doesn't, you know, make a lot of money, the arts.
Is this coming from Speaker Schultz? One of the things you write about is that he has talked about wanting education to operate like a business. Talk a little bit about what he's been saying about how he thinks higher education should work.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting perspective to kind of take on this because, you know, he is a businessman. He also does not have a college degree, but I think that's why you're seeing the buzzwords that you're seeing, right? I mean, efficiency is a business term. That's not a higher education term. Higher education has never really run, quote, efficiently. I mean, we talk about 4-year degrees, but most students actually finish in 6 years. He started before the session talking about a full 10% cut just across the board, which would have been far higher than where we landed. But I mean, yeah, this idea really did come from him and saying, you know, I want to reduce the budgets. And he really looked at administrative costs because he was worried about what he's called administrative bloat and how that cost gets passed down to students. So again, really money focused. That's kind of how he's lined this up.
So what does Speaker Schultz and others who like this idea of a higher education system being more, you know, quote unquote, efficient, what do they think then should happen to people who don't want to study business? They do want to maybe teach French or study French or art history or dance or any of the kind of humanities. Where do they think that should even fit in a sort of university system in a public setting?
On paper, these leaders are saying, oh, we don't want to cut the humanities, like those are still important. But when you look at the actual cuts, I mean, it really does align with what this professor in New York was saying. We cut a lot of the liberal arts. There are still some of these classes, not all of them are gone, but across the board, the liberal arts are what got cut. And I think that these folks would say, go ahead and enjoy the liberal arts when you do your required general education, and then maybe think about picking something that's, you know, not the liberal arts for your career.
Talk about, so what happens then at the legislature? So Speaker Schultz is thinking of, as you say, across the board cut. It's not exactly how it played out. So tell us how it, in fact, does play out at the legislature.
There was a lot of lobbying behind the scenes. So we had the Speaker Schultz come out with the kind of a full 10% idea. In about October, we have this big audit come out the following month. I mean, there's all this pressure on higher education. And we know behind the scenes that some of the university presidents and the leaders of the Utah system of higher education were saying, hey, maybe let's not do a full cut. You know, maybe we can rework this into a reallocation. And so what ends up happening is they take a lower percentage than they thought they were going to. It's still 10%, but it's 10% of a specific line item for instruction.
Right.
So it's not the full budget. And then what happens is that schools essentially have to cut programs, have to cut administration to come up with their total. But if they can go back to the legislature and say, look, we're going to reinvest in the programs that you want to see, these, you know, high paying, lucrative jobs, we're going to reinvest in those areas, then they can earn their money back to put into those programs.
So I'm looking at some of the cuts that have been made already. University of Utah recently cut more than 400 courses, 484 courses, 81 different programs. I'm looking at Utah State. They merged five colleges into two. Weber State cut 89 classes. They eliminated 49 staff positions. Southern Utah University, it seems like they completely cut art history and French and ethnic studies and women and gender studies minors. Utah Tech cut Spanish and theater education majors. There's a lot there that happens. And as you were sort of mentioning before, they weren't cutting any engineering programs. Now, look, because people were filling up engineering programs, I suppose, but the cuts that were made, maybe this made sense. They were the ones that weren't delivering.
I think it's an interesting debate, and you'll hear a lot of talk from faculty in particular who, you know, do question what that delivering means,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What does it mean to deliver on a program? I think one thing that's kind of stood out to me is the U cut master's programs for modern dance and ballet. Mm. And the U was actually one of the first schools in the entire country to actually offer a ballet education program.
Yeah.
So you do have this kind of legacy of the arts here. I mean, you think of Southern Utah, you've got the Shakespeare Festival, we've got Ballet West here. I mean, we do have a rich cultural state full of the arts that the legislature really does love to promote. But then when it came to higher education, it was like, well, this doesn't feed our economy.
It's interesting because lawmakers, they said, look, we're not trying to kill the liberal arts. Don't get too excited. This is about efficiency and it's about job alignment and trimming what the speaker calls bloat. They've said that they're not interested in killing liberal arts and that the cuts are, you know, supposed to be program neutral. But as we've already said, the humanities classes, they're the ones that are getting cut. That's not to mention, by the way, that some of the cultural centers and the DEI programs that have already been cut as mandated by lawmakers. And so the effect for some does seem political or ideological. What are you hearing about that?
I don't think that that perception is wrong. You talk to faculty and I think that they'll tell you that's spot on, essentially. Those are the programs that got cut. Those are the majority. I mean, you can just look at the numbers, right? I mean, if you look at the University of Utah, it cut 81 programs. I'm already missing the math because there have been so many numbers, but
yeah.
I mean, like 22 of those were in the humanities. And I do think that there was this pressure, even though, you know, the legislature saying, oh, it's not liberal arts, you know, there was pressure behind the scenes to bolster the certain programs that they named and not the ones that weren't named.
Going back to what Professor Curry had said to you, in your reporting, were you able to identify a larger plan? The professor said it was a playbook. Like it seemed like that somebody had drawn this up and distributed it to legislatures in red states. Did you find anything like that, a discrete sort of, I don't know, playbook?
I wouldn't say I found anyone red-handed with the playbook, but it does, the model repeats exactly what Curry saw. I mean, it repeats exactly what's happened in other states. It wasn't a secret maneuver that Utah did. This has happened already elsewhere.
There's another effort by lawmakers that I wanted to ask you about that seems to be developing now. And this is this idea of mandating certain foundational courses and texts for public universities. Utah State is one of the pilots for this. It's this known as the Great Questions courses. And the idea is lawmakers want to make sure that universities are teaching predominantly from Western civilization, or at least that that's a key focus. What do you know about that and how is that and how are people reacting to this idea?
This is kind of an interesting, yeah, situation running concurrently. There is just this immense focus on higher education. So yeah, it's this kind of general education focus. General education are the classes that students are usually taking their first 2 years of college or university that are supposed to teach them all different kinds of skills and perspectives. And there's this focus now from Senator John Johnson to have those core curriculum focused on Western civilization and the rise of Christianity, according to his bill. So it's essentially, you know, taking those core classes and making them very prescriptive. I think he would say that it's, his bill is less prescriptive than last year when he ran the same measure and it didn't pass. It passed this year, but now Utah State University is going to run kind of a pilot to study essentially how to do this. The idea proposed was to have all of the schools in the state then take it on after Utah State does the pilot, but other schools have been like, nope, we're not interested. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that shakes out, because general education has essentially been, right, like that's the antidote to the problem of like, oh, we're losing our arts. Oh, it's okay, they'll still be there in general education. But now we have this other general education bill that's like, well, these specific arts or these specific perspectives will still be there.
So let me ask you finally, what are people who are affected by all of this? And by that, I mean, not just the university presidents who have been trying to sort of make sense of all of this, but tell us about the people you're talking to, the professors who teach this. How are they reacting to all of this? And what do they say, or what do they worry about that could be the effect from all of this?
Well, I think at the end of the day, the ones most affected, and that's not to say that faculty losing their job aren't, but it is students. I mean, higher education is supposed to be for students. And when you cut programs and you cut classes, you now have students that have far less options than they had. Even if, you know, it was four students enrolled in a dance program, that's not an option. And that might have been the only school that had it. So now they don't have that option at all in the state. And I think that that's a real concern, is that students may have to go out of state to pursue something that they like, or they'll just give up on pursuing what they like. That's a huge problem. And I think faculty are concerned about that, and rightly also concerned about their jobs. I mean, we can look through the numbers. It was 412 positions total that were eliminated through this, and some of those were replaced. So I think the deficit ends up being about 50 jobs that disappeared. But I think the real concern is just what we're gonna miss out on, right? What is no longer a choice anymore.
Courtney Tanner, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Courtney Tanner, she's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put a link to her reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last legislative session, Utah lawmakers ordered the state's public universities to shift around some priorities when it came to the classes they were offering students. They cut more than $60 million from the school's budgets, but they said you could earn that money back if you shift toward programs that fill high-demand jobs and you slash the ones with few students or limited career paths. Well, at this point, the slashing has been done, mostly. 271 degrees and certificates have been cut. That includes about 80 at the University of Utah. More than 400 staff positions have been impacted. And it was the humanities and the arts that took most of the hits, which is probably no surprise. And it raises the question, where do the liberal arts and humanities fit in higher education these days? Recently, we talked with Jessica Hooten Wilson. She's a professor of humanities at Pepperdine University. She co-edited a book called The Liberating Arts: Why We Need Liberal Arts Education. These days, Utah lawmakers and a lot of people are making this distinction between the practical subjects at school and the ones seen as, intangible. Well, we asked the professor what she made of that distinction.
The weird part of our current cultural moment is what used to be the primary, which was the liberal arts, has now become the marginal and has become, we could do with it or without it, whereas it used to be the center and you could do with or without training for various things, right? The applications were things you can learn in the moment, and because skills change all the time, technology changes all the time, and people knew this for hundreds of years. So you could learn a skill and learn a trade, But what was central was the education that would free your soul, right? The liberal arts, the things that were going to make you free. So we're in a weird moment where we've kind of inverted those two.
Well, take us through that history, or just that sort of brief sense of the history of, help us understand how we got here then. Because you say for most of the history of that country, it wasn't inverted. Half of a person's education included the liberal arts. That was important. So talk a little bit about the history of that.
So you can go all the way back to Socrates and Aristotle, in which Aristotle says that skole, school, right, that word means leisure. So you work really hard in your trade to have time for the important things like leisure. So this was kind of the mentality for people when they started founding schools, such as the Sorbonne or Oxford or later institutions in America. They began as places where scholars were trained in things that made life worth living. Hmm. And people worked to fund that kind of schooling. And so when schools began, when they were first instituted, you had to know your Latin and Greek before you even got in. That was entrance requirements. And then you studied things that we have now relegated to the humanities or liberal arts, but they were the primary part of your education. And it kind of topped off with philosophy and theology at the very end. And this made you able to be a diplomat, a pastor, right? These were the gatekeepers of society, were those who had gone through liberal arts training.
And what happened? Why did it, like, when does it start to shift and evolve, that thinking?
A lot of people will point in America to the shift in the 19th century when we began to have an elective system where you would elect the classes that you wanted. I think it's Harvard 1840s, and it's the Harvard president comes up with this new elective system. And the new elective system allows you to take whatever classes that you want, instead of mandating what classes you take as a student.
Yeah.
And this whole free idea meant a lot of students were not choosing things which for hundreds of years had been the good, true, and beautiful, because those things were more challenging and more difficult. And what 18-year-old, if you're going to give him or her a choice, is going to choose the thing that's going to benefit them in the long run. They're going to choose the thing with the immediate gratification that's a lot easier to get through. And so those changes kind of feed down from that moment. A lot of people point to that moment in the 1840s.
Before all that starts to happen, before it became an elective, why was it a requirement for Latin and Greek? Like, what was the case that they were making that was so important? If they were saying, look, you can go and learn a trade, go be an apprentice, but you need to come here. It's critical for Latin to be a part of the way you look at the world and way you understand the culture. What was the case they were making?
The idea was that the Latin and Greek texts, when they're translated, lose a lot of the meaning in translation. And if you don't know the original text of Aristotle, Thucydides, Herodotus, that's where your history, your literature, your philosophy came from. So the primary objective was history, philosophy, literature, but the means to get there was to know Latin and Greek so that you could read it well. And if you weren't able to read it in the original, were you really reading it? That was kind of the question. So you had to know those things to be able to engage in the bigger questions, because most of Western culture was founded upon Latin and Greek ideas, right, in the West. And so American and Western universities prioritized the study of the original languages that gave us our political thought, that gave us our philosophical understanding of what it means to be human, even that gave us our earliest investigation into the sciences. Of course, that changes in scientific revolution, but our earliest ideas of what culture should look like, where our history comes from so we don't repeat these errors, all of that was in Latin and Greek texts.
So that seems quite practical, though. Like, if we're going to learn that, you got to be able to decipher the actual texts themselves. That seems not theoretical. That seems really pragmatic.
Well, and even so, Virginia Woolf, even in the 1920s, writes an essay in which anyone who doesn't actually know Greek can't read a Greek text. Like, when you read it in translation, you're just missing too much. And if you think about the ways that people misinterpret stuff, and a lot of that happens by not knowing the originals that were handed down to us and what things mean. Even our language, our very language communicates the way that we think about stuff. For example, like the word virtue, right? Of course, has its roots in these Latin and Greek texts to mean innate human excellencies. Later, we use words like values interchangeably with virtue, but values has you can evaluate whether it's good to be honest in that situation, whether it's valuable to you, right, or valuable to a society that you prize honesty or not. Language actually changes the meaning and the ways we situate ourselves in society.
So part of what seems to be happening, as you said, was all of a sudden now they decided, let's let students elect which classes to take. And they take the ones that maybe they don't want to process Aristotle, so they take something else. But was there any other idea out there that was more ideological or political? Because when you hear Utah lawmakers, for example, trying to make public universities here more efficient and the jobs they're training students, you know, to be more financially viable, that just seems like it's a practical endeavor. But it does make you wonder if there's also some ideology or some politics in there too. So what do you make of that larger question?
I think a lot of it has to do with misunderstanding. So when you're trying to aim for what's efficient or financially viable, that's going to change in 10 years. And what the liberal arts education was supposed to be doing is that you were educating a person to be able to adapt to a changing world. We instead are constantly changing our education requirements to adapt to the world that students are currently in, which means you have things like 5 or 6 years ago, computer science was a massive major and everybody was teaching programmers and coders. Well, those jobs are all replaced by AI and all the money we poured into offering coding classes suddenly seems worthless and unnecessary because now it's a new world. So what happens to these people if we keep changing what they're being trained for so quickly? You have people who can't change careers and adapt as quickly because they're only trained in these small skill sets for the trend of the moment.
You have written this, that when liberal arts are relegated from the universal to the purview of eggheads, it's the average person who loses most. Is that where we are right now? The liberal arts are mostly among the eggheads?
I think so. And this is so problematic. Sometimes I'll walk into spaces and people accuse me of being elitist because I'm working on the liberal arts. But if we really believe in freedom as much as we always have, what we should look back in our history and realize is those who were freed by things like the liberal arts. So you look at Frederick Douglass reading alone in his attic because no one was giving him access to the liberal arts. And so he's reading Cicero and Milton and speeches by Washington by himself, and it's freeing his soul so that he goes forth and frees others with his rhetoric, with his activism. They are the truly free things, the freeing things. And if we make it just a scholarly enterprise, what happens to all those people that need to be freed? Well, they're just going to be controlled by whoever's in charge and whoever knows the language of the game.
This gets us to this argument that you're making about maybe why the liberal arts and humanities don't seem to be thought of as important or necessary in the way they used to be. And if I understand it right, what you're arguing is that what happened to the liberal arts is that the people who studied it and taught it just got too specialized.
Well, if you walk into a university today, almost anywhere, and you go to history or English departments, their administration is judging their value to the university based on the number of majors. Yeah. That to me is absurd because you don't need a ton of history majors. You don't need as many history majors as you need pre-med, pre-law, education majors, you know, so forth, because those are the jobs that are going to be out there. What you need is you need a vital history department in which they serve the aim of the overall students of the university. So that when you have students walk across the stage, they took history classes, they took literature classes, they loved them and they were transformed by them, even when they receive a major in something else. And so both, I think, in the faculty and administration, we have this misunderstanding that what makes your department valuable to the university is the number of majors. And that's just not accurate. We need really strong humanities and liberal arts departments because they serve the majority of the students, not because they increase the number of majors we have.
There is, of course, that argument that pushes back against that, that specialization in the humanities isn't a bad thing. It lets scholars, you know, focus more deeply and keep their work strong and help the humanities stay relevant to larger questions. And it's not like you're not saying, if you've always wanted to teach history in college, you shouldn't be able to do that. You're just wondering if there's not quite a balance there. Is that right?
Right. So a lot of financial decisions at universities are made by, okay, we can only have a certain number of history scholars based on the number of majors that they would be advising and overseeing and replacing themselves with, right? We need to increase the numbers who specialize in history. That to me is the problem. So it's not that you don't want to have experts in different fields. I think the expertise in history and literature keeps it going. One of the big downfalls at University of Chicago right now is that they're cutting a lot of those humanities programs, especially at the graduate level, as though you don't need to replace these experts. So I would not want to argue that. There should be experts in literature, history, theology, philosophy. But at the same time, the goal of a faculty member who is going to teach history should not be trying to convert 100 students to become majors. It should be 100 students want to take another history class, a third history class, because it's formative for who they're becoming, even when they're majoring in business. Mm.
You talk about how the liberal arts aren't just about the quote-unquote useful skills, but that they're ways of knowing. Say more about that. What do you mean, the ways of knowing?
Well, knowledge comes in many different forms, and too often we only prize information as the only way of knowing. And so information can just be, you know, facts, figures, data collection, quantifiable information. But knowledge is also how you see the world, what you know to be true, what you know to be good, what you know to be beautiful. Those things are not just emotional responses. They're actually a form of knowing. And this idea that you can't have knowledge of the world outside the facts and figures that are transferable through devices in particular really weakens what it is that we are as knowing creatures in the world. There's so much more to be known that has to do with our senses, with our morals, there's lots of forms of knowledge. And we've really reduced this to only the kind of knowledge that can be quantifiable.
You've talked about there being this kind of disconnect between the liberal arts and this expectation that it's going to give us something back in that way, like a sense of virtue. So how does virtue fit in that? Make that case. Say a little bit more about that. Do you say that the idea of values or virtue is kind of missing nowadays?
Virtue, the word was originally understood as human excellence.
Yeah.
And when you take it back to that meaning, then it starts to look more necessary than we currently make it, because we have created a way of seeing the world in which virtues are dispensable. They're open to preference. They are relative to what you like or don't like and what you want to do and what you don't want to do. That's not what virtues ever were. Virtues were all human beings are human. They share some things in common. And they can function best as humans when they pursue human excellencies such as courage, justice, wisdom, temperance, right? These were human excellencies that all human beings should pursue. And education used to be forming you against certain wants that were not towards human excellence. Hmm. And these courses in history, for example, history would train you away from vanity or false pride because you saw yourself within this larger story that began before you and continues after you. And that way of knowing then had you pursue a certain understanding of justice and self-discipline that looked different than a person who was unaware of the historical context he or she was in.
You've said that there's this lost desire. I think that's how you put it. This lost desire in society for virtue to be taught. Explain what you mean and give us a sense of why you think that is now.
Well, if you go to an average 18-year-old at this point and you say, I know that studying philosophy is difficult. I know it's challenging, but it will actually make you a better person. He or she might be tempted to respond, what, is there something wrong with me right now? There's a misunderstanding that they have a telos in which they are becoming better and better all the time, and that's the goal. And instead, we've lost even that want to become better and better people, right? That there could even be a human excellence that we should strive for. Instead, we've kind of settled for the very smallest things in our life, just having pleasure, just being entertained. This becomes a huge problem if you look at history, because throughout the world, the people who are easy to control are those who only want pleasure and entertainment. Mm. And political figures have been able to control those people. Crazy theologians have been able to control those people with wrong religious movements. And people are easily controlled when they don't desire something more for themselves as human beings.
It seems like that's the case that Martin Scorsese was making a few years ago when he was critical of all the Marvel films. He said the problem is that those films, and you've talked about this, that those films feed the people the lowest thing that they can desire. And so he said, so your taste just sort of sits there, like it never changes. Say a little bit more about what he's getting at there, because it seems like that idea of taste just sort of being stagnant or not wanting to demand more from the culture or yourself is an important point that you're thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And before I sound too much just like an egghead, I watch all the Marvel movies.
Yeah, so. Right. You're not being a buzzkill is what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Right. I love the Marvel universe. I love those movies. But what he's trying to get at is something goes back to the 4th century. St. Augustine used to say to the sick person, right? So imagine this kind of as a sick soul. To the sick person, even the sweetest bread will taste bitter because people don't know how to desire what's good for them. And I see this in people who have read my book. I wrote a book about reading. And at first, they were reading things like Amish romances or kind of like your lowest pulp fantasy, just kind of your bestsellers, or even like self-published books that aren't written that well. And they don't know to want or desire more than that. And when my friends or people who've emailed me have read my book, they tried to read great literature for the first time. And they found they couldn't go backwards. Once they had claimed a taste for a good novel, for something that was beautiful, when they went back and tried to read the things they'd been reading for years, it didn't satisfy them because their taste had changed. So when you challenge yourself to also read beyond your taste or desire art beyond your taste, suddenly you find that you yourself have a better palate than you ever thought you did. And you want some of those higher things. And then I think you have a culture who then supplies those higher things, and a culture that hopefully is supplying eternal and long-lasting and enduring things rather than one who only supplies disposable, dispensable artifacts.
Jessica Houghton Wilson, she's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University, co-editor of the book, The Liberating Arts, Why We Need Liberal Arts Education. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the future of liberal arts at public universities today. Utah lawmakers have asked the colleges here to reassess the efficiency of the classes they offer. And it's the humanities courses that mostly are getting cut. So we're talking with humanities professor Jessica Houghton Wilson about why the liberal arts still matter. And not just for jobs, but the kind of citizen you want in a society. I was wondering about the practical value of a humanities education, or the humanities being part of an education. Something you have talked about just in conversations you have with customer service people and your kind of frustration over that. When you have conversations that drive you crazy, what are you hearing in there that tells you they probably didn't get some of those virtues played out in their education? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I interact with way too many human beings now who do not desire to be good. And it sounds such a silly thing to say, but, you know, if you've been driving on the road people who don't let another person through. Or travel, I think, is one of the easiest ones because I probably fly every weekend, every other weekend or so. Like I fly out 2 or 3 times a month. And it used to be only 5 or 6 years ago, there were just some manners that basic people followed on airplanes. You let other people go first. Yeah. If someone was trying to catch a flight, you excuse them and let them run ahead of you. And when you're exiting the plane, you would help people put their suitcases up or get their suitcases down. People with small children, you would help a mom with a stroller, right? There was just this like natural manners as a society that we just assumed.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is just missing. And more and more people have bought into this idea that they are the center of the universe. And I really do think it's happened in colleges, right? We cater to whatever class you want to take. The professors are your customer service representatives and you are the customer buying something. Or even your phone, right? You get what you want, when you want it, how you want it. So the whole world is just mediating this narrative in which you are the center of things rather than what is the common good? What is the societal good? And this has really run over into lots of different industries and forms in society.
Is it about humility and restraint? Those are the things you draw from, you know, a humanities least aspect of education?
Yeah, let me give an example with literature that's really easy. I think I've given an example of history. In literature, you shut up for just 2 seconds while you're reading another sentence.
Yeah.
You're reading someone else's words. You are either living vicariously through another character or you are listening to a nonfiction book in which someone else is talking and not you. There are moments that require you to not be the center of your universe when you are reading, right? When you are doing these other things. And more practice in that, more time in that, you stop seeing yourself as the center of the world. You see other people's stories. You see other people's stories throughout time and place and sex and gender and race and demographics. And suddenly the world is not just about you and you're not the only one in it. Your way of seeing things is not the only way to see things. So a humanities education is supposed to provide that so that when you go back out into the world, you see people and realize they each have their own story. They each have their own perspective. And what can I learn from them? How can I be in conversation with them? How can I help them? That way of seeing is a way of knowing that requires training.
You told us this story about your Sunday school class. You asked this group of 9-year-olds what they wanted to be when they grew up. And you seemed to draw kind of not lesson from it, but it was instructive about how young people are kind of making this calculus of how they want to, you know, live their lives. Will you tell that story?
Sure. I was teaching a Sunday school class and I had this young lady who was especially good at writing poetry. And I said, "You're really good at this. You know, I'm a poet too. Like, poetry is so beautiful. I hope you keep pursuing this." And she said, "Well, I told my parents that I wanted to major in creative writing," right? She's 9. "But my parents said, I can't be a poet when I grow up. I need to major in business because it's practical." And I just thought, wait, you're 9. What? Like, in what world are we now living where you don't encourage a 9-year-old to write poetry? That to me is just a given. And we have 5-year-olds. You want them to love reading. It's only when they're 20 that we have at least, you know, had this problem where we're saying it's not practical anymore. Stop writing poetry. Stop reading books. But even that, of course, to me is a problem. But when we're all the way back to teaching 9-year-olds that poetry is not useful, but a business degree is, we are just creating a different kind of person.
How do you think artificial intelligence, AI, this moment fits into the larger question? I mean, one of the things you've talked about is being concerned that we're kind of outsourcing some of the most important aspects of being human, you know, to a machine. So how are you thinking about AI? It seems like what you're saying is we're going to need the humanities even more if we're going to make sense of this moment.
Right. I think so. Well, we don't have the philosophical framework for understanding AI and its relation to our humanness like we should. I'm not saying AI is not a useful tool when it replaces other tools that don't detract from what it means to be a human being. For example, if you are trying to create a bunch of program outcomes and you hand a bunch of program outcomes to ChatGPT and it can summarize them for you. Okay, well, I don't think it detracts from our humanness, right, in that sense. But if you are trying to read Paradise Lost for the first time and you ask ChatGPT to summarize Paradise Lost, what has happened there? In both instances, the technology was summarizing. But in one instance, it was summarizing something bureaucratic to respond to other bureaucracies to help a non-human thing keep happening. Yeah. It was required. In the other, you've lost the human-centered, the struggle of engaging the text, the struggle of reading the first line of Paradise Lost, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, right? Where you're like, wait, why did the sentence start with the word of? Did I miss a page? Were things stuck together? Mm-hmm. You miss the struggle and the mental activity of trying to figure things out. We're going to have a bunch of human beings who have offloaded that neural capacity to be able to figure out something, right? Mm-hmm. And to struggle mentally through an activity of thinking. That to me becomes problematic.
There's something you write in this introduction to this book you edited about the humanities. And this is how you put it. You said, our aim is not just to mount an argument for the enduring relevance of the liberal arts tradition, but, and this is how you put it, it's to model the kind of conversation and friendship that liberal arts formation makes possible. Can you say more about the friendship part and maybe even modeling the conversation part?
Yes, absolutely. So in June of 2025, Time Magazine put out an MIT study, which was showing the effects of ChatGPT on students who are currently using it in education. And one of the things that struck me was the increased loneliness of these students. You expect things like memory loss and critical thinking loss. The loneliness was a little bit unexpected for most people. But of course, I wrote this friendship piece in 2020. So I was expecting this kind of thing to happen, because what actually occurs is you start depending on one another in education. Mm-hmm. Students depend on one another to help get through. Wait, I didn't understand Paradise Lost, did you? Or I didn't understand that physics problem. Can you help me? Do you have another way of explaining it? Right? Or even working with a professor and becoming friends with a professor. You know, I've really loved this class. You know, could you help me with my essay? And we have at the center of education always put relationships. It was a matter of elders and peers and mentors and guides, and it was human-centered. And that human-centered is gone. And when you become a person who learns online by yourself in a room using ChatGPT to accomplish the tasks, you've created a false environment. Human beings were not meant to be by themselves. And especially when it comes to education or our labor, our vocations, all of these things were meant to be interactive. And so we've lost friendship that was at the heart. And the humanities discipline really showcases this, right? We read old dead people because we believe in this like friendship across time and place. Yeah. And we read other authors because we believe that each of these books have something to say, because we believe in listening to other people. And then we come into a classroom where we discuss it with one another and push back and refute each other and dialogue. And we can debate really heady ideas about, you know, what does it mean to be human? Is there a difference between men and women? Are we made political animals, right? All of these kinds of questions we can disagree on and still be with friends doing it. And we're in a society now where disagreement's not possible, civility's not possible, and even learning has been isolated just to a lone individual.
Well, that gets me, I guess, to my final question. In this argument you're making, in this case you're making for the relevance of, you know, liberal arts, how's it going? is it working? I mean, making this case, or is the current just sort of political moment, or just wherever, however you want to describe it, is it just making it more difficult to make that case?
Yeah, I mean, it frustrates me a little bit that it's been a decade of me doing this. Because, you know, I write on Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn and Flannery O'Connor, and I write on these writers that I love, but I spend more of my time speaking publicly or defending just the nature of reading itself.
Now, it doesn't give me a complete loss of hope because I do have a historical understanding. And even when the barbarians sacked Rome, right, there's always been a rebirth. So it's not going to be impossible that these things are going to keep going. Human beings love good things, and that's going to continue. And if we've lost our way, and as majority takes over that considers these things not worthwhile, there's always going to be a remnant or a minority that holds fast. It was that way when the monks in Ireland continued copying manuscripts, even while the rest of the world looked like it was burning. These are things that just will continue. So I'm not a hopeless person. I'm a really optimistic person. But yes, I hope they change faster rather than slower.
Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University, co-editor of the book, The Liberating Arts, Why We Need Liberal Arts Education. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.